Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now are Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press and is the author of Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he also has an article at the Los Angeles Times. If Trump wants to get reelected, he should rethink his Federal Reserve picks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And it seems as though Trump hired Jerome Powell, one, because he's a Republican, but two, because the incumbent, who everybody was happy with, was appointed by Obama. So is that why he got rid of Janet Yellen, do you think?
Well, that certainly seems to be the case. And to be fair, you know, the president does get to pick who he wants for the Federal Reserve chair. But 2 points here. There is this tradition of keeping someone over. So Volcker was a pick by Carter. Reagan came in and kept Volcker there for another term. Greenspan was originally picked by Reagan, reappointed by the first Bush, and then reappointed by Clinton, and then the second Bush, who then appointed Bernanke, who was then reappointed by Obama. So there is that tradition. And then on top of that, of course, Yellen had really done an outstanding job by almost anyone's account. I mean, I criticized her. She had some rate hikes I didn't like, but pretty hard to, on the whole, look at her tenure, 4 years in as Fed chair, and have much to complain about. So I think part of the story probably is, basically, if Obama did it, he wants to undo it, and probably not a good practice, just as a matter of course.
But what your article in the LA Times points out is that Trump may well be working against his own interests here. If he wants to get reelected, the trajectory that Powell has put the Fed on is likely to slow the economy, and if, as the old adage goes, it's the economy, stupid, is the real reason why presidents get reelected, then how much do you think Jerome Powell is going to damage Trump's reelection promises?
Yeah, well, I think there's real grounds for concern. Just to be clear, I'm not anxious to see Donald Trump reelected, but the point here is I do want to see people have jobs, and there's other reasons I think people have to vote against Donald Trump that other than we have a bad economy. But I'm sure if we do have a bad economy come 2020, it hugely reduces the likelihood he'll be reelected. And the story with Powell is that he's not an economist. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but that makes him presumably less sure in his views, less likely to carry the day. To be clear, at the Fed, the way this works, it's a little convoluted, but you have a committee of 19 people, 12 of whom vote at any one meeting, and the chair just has one of the 12 votes. The chair is hugely influential, so it's not just one person. But on the other hand, if people are allied against the chair is not going to carry the day. And Yellen was very adept at getting her views through and ensuring that the Fed didn't raise interest rates rapidly. And the problem is that you have other people on the Fed who are anxious to raise interest rates rapidly. And in fact, many economists outside the Fed think that the Fed has waited too long and raising rates have been too slow. And Powell, I think, will be much less prepared to resist that sort of pressure than Yellen might have been, given her stature. She'd been before Fed chair. She'd been vice chair. She was president of San Francisco Fed. She had earlier served as a governor in addition to being a professor, a well-respected professor at Berkeley. So she had a lot of standing. Her views commanded a lot of respect in the way that Powell can't count on.
So what are the, just to give us a quick economics briefing, what are the consequences of raising interest rates?
Yeah, the basic story, and people don't appreciate this, and they almost think I'm being conspiratorial, but this is the Fed. People follow the Fed, they know this, and the Fed's open on this. It's not a secret. When they raise rates, it's slowing the economy, means fewer jobs being created. And the logic is that when rates are higher, suppose the mortgage interest rate were higher, will people be less likely to buy a home, or they'll pay less for the home? And that will mean less construction from the standpoint of companies that might be looking to invest. Well, if they have to pay more to borrow, well, they'll invest less. And same with state and local governments. State and local governments issued bonds to finance infrastructure. Well, if they have to pay another percentage point on those bonds, well, they'll be less likely to spend money on infrastructure. So it slows the economy in a variety of different ways, and long and short, what that means is fewer jobs and higher unemployment. And that also has the effect that with higher unemployment, of course, workers have less bargaining power, so that means less wage growth. So that's a very bad story in my book, and the concern I have is that the Fed will be raising rates because it's always, they say they're concerned about inflation, and no doubt about it, if you have a slower economy, less risk of inflation, but to my view, there's just very little reason to be concerned about inflation at this point, and we should basically be having the Fed try and keep the economy going strongly and get the unemployment rate down as much as possible.
So Trump, though, does appear to operate entirely on his own image or how his own image is being perceived, and he apparently spends more time watching television about him and how he's being reviewed and discussed by the press than he does doing anything else during the day, sometimes as much as 8 hours of watching television. So this is a peculiar presidential kind of work schedule. And more recently, there's some speculation that the reason he announced these tariffs on steel and aluminum, which appear to be completely off the cuff, were to do with the election that just took place in Pennsylvania. That's one of the explanations being offered, because it caught everybody by surprise and made no sense. And it alarmed Mitch McConnell and Speaker Ryan for the very reasons we're discussing the implications of what the Fed is up to, that they thought that these tariffs would cause economic disruption, perhaps even a trade war, and would slow down the benefits of Trump's tax cuts. So what's your analysis of that? Is Trump capable of hurting his best chances of retaining the House and Senate, not to mention, as you pointed out in your article in the Los Angeles Times, his chances in 2020 of being reelected if the Fed continues what it's doing?
I think there's a real risk of that. I mean, clearly he's not someone who thinks things through carefully. I think it's very plausible that he imposed these tariffs just for the election in Pennsylvania. It turned out, I mean, it may have helped, who knows, but at the end of the day, his guy lost, so wasn't able to hold on to the seat. And just to be clear with the tariffs, I mean, I think people have exaggerated somewhat how bad they are, but they really were kind of off the cuff in the sense that you could make an argument for tariffs in some circumstances. He earlier had imposed tariffs on China for exports of washing machines and solar panels, and I wasn't a fan of those, particularly the solar panel one, but those actually went through a process that was begun under President Obama. It was a review by the U.S. International Trade Commission. That's a nonpartisan body, and to my knowledge, I don't even think Trump's had a single appointee yet. They ruled that China was unfairly subsidizing its exports, and that it would be appropriate for the United States to impose some countervailing measures like tariffs. So that was following through a well-established process. This is entirely off the cuff, and it's not clear. There's not a specific objection that he has in terms of our trading partners. He's going to Canada. He's unhappy that they have a trade surplus with us. He's unhappy European Union has a trade surplus. But what are they doing? And that he's not established. So it's sort of like if we're playing a tennis game and you beat me and I'm upset at you for beating me. Well, you know, I should try harder next time or something. I mean, if I could show you cheated, you know, you called balls out that were in, well, then I have something to complain about. But if you just beat me, well, you know, play a better game. And this kind of is the character of his tariffs. And it really undermines the international trading system. Again, I'm not going to say it's all going to unravel and people are saying we're going to have a trade war and this and that. We certainly could, but this measure by itself doesn't mean a full-fledged trade war, but it doesn't have any obvious economic logic like the earlier tariffs that he imposed on China for solar panels and washing machines.
But this does feel a little bit like the gang that couldn't shoot straight with the Secretary of Commerce and the trade rep, not the trade rep, but the special trade. I can't remember what Peter Navarro's position is in the White House, but those are the two that apparently weighed in. And as we know, it cost Gary Cohn the job as a chief economic advisor, and now he's replaced by a TV pitchman, Lawrence Kudlow.
Yeah.
So I know we spoke a lot at the time of the TPP, but when I say it's the gang that couldn't shoot straight, if your complaints are largely about China, why punish Japan, Canada, and Mexico?
Exactly. It makes no sense. Again, if it's determined, and I think there's a good case, but we have a process. If it's determined that China is subsidizing its steel, and I think we actually already have made that determination, already have some tariffs on Chinese exports, but again, you could make those larger if that's appropriate. But there is a clear process, and again, it's not, what is it that he doesn't want Canada to do that they're doing? What is it that he doesn't want the European Union to do that they're doing? I mean, if there's something concrete, spell out what it is, and that's what you negotiate over. But just saying we have a deficit with them and I'm angry about it, well, that's a little silly.
Well, what was lost in the news cycle about the portent of a trade war was that the vestiges, if you will, of the TPP signed a kind of TPP-type agreement that led by the Japanese and all the other 11 Pacific partners without the United States. I know at the time the TPP, the coverage that I did was all very critical. I had Laurie Wallach on a number of times, who's a real critic of the TPP. And in general, as things have evolved later, it does seem to me that much of the attacks on the TPP were overblown in the sense that in many ways it was a political arrangement attempting to get China and Russia to play by the rules by organizing the neighborhood in a way that they would have to follow the rules. And the first thing that Trump did was get rid of TPP, which most analysts say was a massive gift to China, and it's the gift that keeps on giving. And many people also say that had the TPP been in place, China would have been forced to play by the rules, and certainly the leader, Xi Jinping, wouldn't have been able to declare himself leader for life because now it's the U.S. that's isolated, not China.
Well, I'm no expert in Chinese politics, but I wouldn't bet on the TPP being the big factor in his ability to declare himself, or at least to remove term limits. Whether he's leader for life or not, I don't know. But in any case, they did remove term limits, so that opens the door that he could be leader for life. But I wouldn't attribute too much to the TPP in that story. I should also point out that the idea of the TPP was mainly about containing China. That came up kind of late in the game. So basically, they were trying to sell it as this big economic windfall. And when that argument pretty much fell apart, because there isn't much there in terms of what we could say will benefit the ordinary person in the United States, then they started pushing the contain China story. And I'll just say, I'm not going to say I read every word in it, but having read through it, it's not something that is obviously written and contain China. I'll mention one thing in particular, rules of origin. Rules of origin get fairly technical, but long and short, what it says is how much of a product has to be produced by one of the member countries in order to get special treatment. So to take the obvious example, cars. So if we have a car that's assembled in Mexico, does it get special treatment under NAFTA? Well, rules of origin say, I think the number 65% has to, of the content, of the value add of the car, has to be produced in either Canada, Mexico, or the United States in order to get special treatment under NAFTA. If there's only 40% or 35%, doesn't count. Well, the rules of origin are much weaker in the TPP. They're 35% for most items. It varies by product, but for most items, it's 35%, which means that a lot of items that are most of their value added comes from elsewhere can get favored treatment under the TPP. Well, elsewhere in that story is most likely China. If you're trying to construct this as something to work against China, you probably wanted high rules of origin. You probably wanted something like 50% or 55% or whatever. I mean, one could figure out what the exact number is. But you probably want a fairly high number because you want China to know they're not in it. Whereas with 35%, I'll guarantee you there's going to be fudging on that because, needless to say, it's hard to enforce 35%. If it's 30%, who's going to be able to say? But in any case, China is going to be able to get a lot of its exports into the TPP because you have very weak rules of origin. So it does not look like a pact that was organized against China in spite of what we're being sold right now.
Well, let's turn a little bit we mentioned Gary Cohn quitting over Trump's sort of off-the-cuff decision to raise tariffs on steel by 25% and on aluminum by 10%. And it does seem to some extent they're trying to walk that back. But the replacement for Cohn, who's from Goldman Sachs, is this TV guy, Lawrence Kudlow from CNBC, who seems like a real lightweight. He's an absolute sycophant. I mean, he's just saying the most glowing things about what a wonderful man Donald Trump is in the way. Remember Scaramucci, the mooch, the same
thing? Yeah.
It's sort of reminiscent of that a little bit. Presumably he'll last a little longer than the mooch. But he's a supply-side tax cut champion, right? There's nothing.
Yeah, no, I know Larry Kudlow a bit because I've been on his show a number of times, and he'd begin his show saying, "I believe in free markets, free trade, and free enterprise." And he was always for tax cuts, deregulation everywhere. Said, pronounced global warming a hoax. He's not the guy you want in that position. The head of the National Economic Council is supposed to bring together the views of different heads of agencies for policy. So if you're talking about housing policy, they should be talking to people at the Treasury Department, presumably Council of Economic Advisors, and HUD, Housing and Urban Development, and bring their views to the president and go, here are the main issues. I don't see Kudlow as a good person to do that. So what I would worry about is that whatever Trump wakes up in the morning saying we're going to do X, Y, and Z, Kudlow will probably go, yeah, that's a great idea. And that doesn't sound like a good thing when the president is Donald Trump.
And that, unfortunately, is the case now with the Secretary of State, another sycophant. So on the foreign policy field, we have the same dynamic.
Yeah, and that's probably even more of a concern because bad economic policy usually is at least in part reversible. If we start a war, the consequences are not reversible.
Well, on that cheery note, Dean Baker, I thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest book is Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he also has an article at the Los Angeles Times. If Trump wants to get reelected, he should rethink his Federal Reserve picks. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.